Hello, this is Chris Yerkes reading to you from the November 12th edition of the County Chronicle. We'll begin with the first page stories. Tuscola City Council. Tax rate to go down, ratify police contract by David Porter. The Tuscola City Council is expected to adopt a levy increase of 4.95% for next year, just 0.05% below what would trigger a truth in taxation hearing. However, Treasurer Alta Long said the city's tax rate is expected to go down as the equalized assessed valuation in Tuscola is expected to increase 8%. The tax rate went down last year despite a levy increase due to rising EAV. It has steadily declined over the past 5 years. One factor was the retirement of two of the city's tax increment finance TIF districts in 2022. The city has only one TIF district remaining. The influx of EAV allowed the city to raise its levy while lowering the overall tax rate, which dropped below $1 per 100 of EAV last year. Long noted that only 20% of the city's income comes from property taxes. People will still complain about their tax bill, she said, but noted the school district receives the bulk of local tax revenue. The city council approved a new agreement with the police union on its Monday meeting following a brief closed session. Under the new agreement, the night shift premium pay will increase from 50 cents to $1 per hour, and there will be a special duty certification premium of 50 cents per hour. This includes field training officer, juvenile officer, sexual assault investigator, firearms instructor, and taser instructor. The current salary schedule is unchanged, but officers received a 3% wage increase on May 1, 2026, 2027, and 2028. There will be a 2.5% pay increase at 5 years of service and a $1 increase after completion of a probationary period. The 1 year probationary period is from the date of hire or completion of academy training. New Year's Eve will now be a full day holiday, up from half a day. The new contract changes dispute and grievance procedures. City Administrator Drew Howell said it's consistent with union procedures. Paid time off, health and life insurance, and most other policies are unchanged, he said. The city retains management rights concerning staffing levels, shifts, budgets, policies, and equipment. The agreement lasts from November 15th through April 30th, 2028. The council also received the city's annual audit from Larson Woodyard Henson LLP. Auditor Curtis Root said it was a clean audit with no issues to report. He said the city's financial position increased $1.8 million to $51 million. The bulk of the increase was in the water and sewer operation, he said. The government side increased in value by $327,000. He noted that the joint water agency co-owned with Arcola showed a profit of nearly $400,000, which he said is an improvement over past years. The JWA distributed surplus funds of $363,000 back to the cities. In other business, the council approved a pay request to CNS companies for the Meadowview Water Main project in the amount of $84,000 and to AKRA Builders for a pool house renovation in the amount of $56,000. A change order of $2,400 was approved for the pool house renovation. Also approved was a $14,800 contract with Swindeman Incorporated for audiovisual upgrades at the community building and a $12,000 contract amendment with Donahue PSA for installation of equipment at the city's master meter station, water department. Holiday bonuses of $200 were approved for full-time employees and firefighters. During the mayor's portion of the meeting, Mayor Dan Kleiss congratulated Kate Foltz and Blake Lessie for their state cross country performances and a fine season. The next article, Newman City Council, EPA loan application updates on projects by Ben Crane. The Newman City Council on Monday approved an ordinance to borrow funds through the Environmental Protection Agency's Water Supply Loan Program, which will support additional upgrades to the city's water system. During the meeting, Shiloh High School industrial arts teacher Mark Williams spoke about the return of the school's program after a year-long hiatus. Williams said he is seeking half-day off-campus internship opportunities for students and requested city representatives to serve on an advisory board, a requirement to help secure state funding for the program. In other business, Jackie Joynes, representing the Daughters of the American Revolution, discussed plans for the nation's upcoming 250th anniversary. Joynes encouraged Newman to become an official America 250 community, joining neighboring communities including Arcola, Tuscola, Arthur, and Atwood. She explained the steps necessary for the designation and the potential community benefits of participation. The Newman GOAL committee provided further updates on logistics for the upcoming Christmas extravaganza, which will feature holiday activities throughout downtown. Under the street and alley report, officials noted repairs to the community building roof and discussed long-term needs for replacement, which would cost about $100,000. The council also approved the purchase of a portable ramp for one of the building's entrances at $7,000 and reviewed a bid for a new backhoe snowblade from Berkey's, priced at $10,600. The Waterworks Department reported that the cathodic protection system installed last year continues to function effectively following its one-year inspection. Lights and decals have been added to the new city water trucks. Council members also discussed rebidding for a new water truck in the spring after expressing dissatisfaction with the proposals received during the initial bidding process. The next first page article, Tuscola principal resigns. Records show district paid more than $22,000 for outside counsel and investigators while withholding key findings, by Ben Crane. North Ward Elementary Principal Jason Wallace has submitted his resignation from Tuscola Community Unit School District 301 following a months-long investigation that has cost taxpayers more than $80,000 to date. Wallace was placed on administrative leave in early April. At that time, Superintendent Gary Alexander said the action did not involve any issues related to the students or their well-being. He confirmed Monday that Wallace has resigned effective November 24th. The resignation follows two other related resignations. Kara Short, a paraprofessional, resigned in mid-August, stating she was leaving a workplace that no longer feels safe or supportive. Most of her resignation letter, obtained through Freedom of Information Act, the FOIA request, was redacted. Short was an aide in Lisa Cunningham's early childhood special education classroom. Cunningham resigned in July after 18 years. Records obtained by the county's Chronicle's FOIA request show that legal fees related to Wallace's suspension totaled more than $22,000 and referenced a Title IX investigation. Title IX is a broad federal law that refers to sexual discrimination and or harassment. The record shows that Wallace continued to receive his salary while on leave, nearly $60,000. The findings of the investigation were not released. Records show the district hired three law firms and an outside Title IX investigator between January and November 2025. Invoices and payroll records released under the FOIA show that Wallace remained on paid leave for at least 7 months as the investigation unfolded. According to invoices, InCompliance Consulting of Columbus, Ohio was retained to conduct the investigation. Billing records identify the case as matter ID 198593 and show that the firm was paid $14,800 between May and August for conducting interviews, drafting notices, and preparing a final report. The district also paid $5,800 to Miller Tracy Brown Funk & Miller Limited of Monticello for legal coordination and document review, and $1,500 to Franchek PZ of Chicago for policy consultation and board advisement later in the process. All payments came from the district's legal services account, listed in the documents as 80.2369.318.1. Payroll records list Wallace under the name Robert J. Wallace and show $58,800 in gross pay between April and October 2025, with no overtime or deductions. The totals align with full salary continuation during leave. A copy of Wallace's contract, signed in May 2024 and effective through June 30, 2027, outlined standard administrative terms, including annual salary increases, benefits, and evaluation procedures. The district's three-page FOI response, dated November 10th, acknowledged receipt of the request filed October 27th seeking documents related to Wallace's leave, salary continuation, legal invoices, and resignation letters from two other employees. The district released more records, but without the most personnel matters, citing Section 7-1, A, B, F, M, and N of the Illinois Freedom of Information Act. These sections allow public bodies to withhold private information, attorney-client communications, deliberative materials, and records relating to employee discipline. The district declined to release the investigative report, any internal correspondence, or any record of final findings, citing confidentiality and legal protections. Under state law, public bodies must release the final outcomes of any disciplinary action taken against an employee, though no such record was included in the district's response. Invoices and correspondence indicate the investigation began early in 2025 and continued in late summer, followed by a board-level consultation for through the fall. Superintendent Alexander's name appears as the point of contact on nearly every billing record, and later invoices from Sanchek PSE reference policy and governance discussion with the Board of Education. The district's legal expenditures between January and November totaled $22,000. The investigation and subsequent resignation mark a period of turnover at the administrative and staff levels within the district. As of this week, no additional documents related to the investigation or Wallace's resignation have been posted on the district's website or discussed in open session. Efforts by the County Chronicle to seek comments from Wallace went unanswered Monday. The next article, Douglas County Residents Navigate SNAP Delays Amid National Funding Lapse, by Ben Crane. When the federal government stalls, the effects reach even the smallest corners of Illinois. For many Douglas County residents relying on Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, benefits, that reality has become increasingly clear over the past several weeks. Douglas County Health Department Administrator Amanda Miner said local staff had been fielding a growing number of calls from residents worried about when or if their benefits will load onto their cards. They said they are getting half at least loaded on their cards, the ones that have been calling in, Miner said. People are calling and asking about more food pantries. They're just trying to figure out what their options are. The uncertainty stems from a prolonged funding delay at the federal level, part of a broader government shutdown that has put programs like SNAP and WIC under pressure. While national officials continue to assure states that funding will be on hold for now, those assurances have shifted several times already. In October, it was like, oh, until the end of October, Miner said. Then it was, oh, until mid-November. We'll have another call later this week, but we just don't know what's next. For families across rural Douglas County, that uncertainty hits harder than numbers on a spreadsheet. Grocery options are limited, food prices have climbed, and small-town food pantries, often run out of churches or community buildings, are feeling the strain. Miner said her staff have been working closely with these groups to make sure residents have somewhere to turn. We're working with our local food pantries. We have all the information available if people call us, she said. And we're seeing churches really step up, doing community meals, blessing boxes, donation drives. That's one of the good things about Douglas County. Everyone gives more than they have to. The health department is also using this moment to connect families to other programs. If they have children 5 and under, they might be eligible for WIC, Miner said. That's another way we can make sure pregnant women and young kids are getting the nutrition they need. But even with the stopgap efforts in place, the emotional toll is growing. I think the biggest fear is uncertainty, Miner said. It's very hard to plan when you don't know what you don't know. When you're worrying about food and shelter, your basic needs, it's hard to focus on work, school, and family. Residents looking for help can call 211, a community resource hotline that connects caller with nearby food pantries, housing assistance, counseling services, and other programs based on zip code. The Douglas County Health Department also continues to provide on-site support, including a nurse practitioner, a part-time counselor, and several community-based programs such as Laundry Love. Miner encouraged anyone struggling to reach out, even if it's just to ask for information. We know it's a trying time, she said. Your health matters too, mental and physical. Let us help where we can. Between our office, the food pantries, the churches, and other groups like BASE and ROSC, there are people there who want to help. For now, there's cautious optimism that state funding will hold through the month. But in Douglas County, like many rural areas across the country, residents are prepared for whatever comes next. As Miner put it, it's hard to plan when the future keeps moving, but most people here keep finding ways to help each other. That's what makes this community special. In the last first page article, Garrett Woman Found Dead Inside Burned Out Home, by Ben Crane. Garrett was shaken awake early Thursday morning when a fire destroyed a home and the homeowner's body was found inside. According to the Douglas County Sheriff's Office, deputies and firefighters were dispatched around 2:11 a.m. to report a structure fire at 301 Southwest 3rd Street. When first responders arrived, the single-story home was already heavily engulfed in flames. After the fire was brought under control, investigators discovered the body of the homeowner, identified as 42-year-old Jennifer M. Chandler. She was pronounced dead at the scene. Authorities have not yet determined the cause of the fire. Investigations remain active and is being jointly handled by the Douglas County Sheriff's Office, Douglas County Coroner's Office, Atwood Fire Department, and the Illinois State Fire Marshal's Office. Douglas County Coroner Lisa Edwards said the autopsy was scheduled for Friday and that more answers will be provided from it. The results should be back in around 2 weeks, she said. We'll move now to the obituaries. Helen Yarnell Sylvester, 95, of Arcola, passed away at 9:24 a.m. on Friday, November 7th, at 2025 at Sarah Bush Lincoln Health Center in Mattoon. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, November 14th, at the Edwards Funeral Home, 221 East Main in Arcola. Graveside service will be held Saturday, November 16th at 1 p.m. in the Arcola Cemetery. Lloyd David Camp, 77, of Arthur, passed away Tuesday, November 4th, 2025, at the Haven of Tuscola in Tuscola. Visitation will be held Saturday, November 15th, from 10 a.m. to 12 noon at Penn Station, 122 East Progress Street in Arthur. Schrader Funeral Home is assisting the family with arrangements. Dora Anderson, 101, of Arcola, living in Scottsdale, Arizona, passed away on Saturday, November 1st, 2025, at the Arizona residence of David and Christine Anderson. Funeral services were held Friday, November 7th, at the HCK West Building, south of Arthur. Bishop Daniel Rock officiated. Burial was in the Yoder Cemetery in Arthur. Visitation was held Thursday, November 6th, at the HCK West Building. The Edwards Funeral Home assisted with arrangements. The next article, Two Douglas County Young Men at War, Far From Home, by Mike Carroll. This is the story of two Douglas County men, barely out of high school, one from Arcola, Robert Popeye Pullen, and the other from Atwood, Homer Carroll, my father. They played football against each other. They both went to war as Navy seamen. My dad returned home to lead a fortunate and full life while Popeye died a horrible death in the jungles of Burma over 80 years ago during World War II. Popeye Pullen has been called by many the best football player of his era in Douglas County, possibly the best ever. My dad garnered no such accolades. He just enjoyed being part of the Atwood team. Some years ago, I asked my mother, a Tuscola graduate, the question of who was the best local football player she ever saw. Oh, that's easy, she said, Popeye Pullen. Why was he the best, I asked. She answered, because when Popeye hit you, you got brain damage. But didn't Dad play against him? To the best of my knowledge, he didn't suffer from brain damage, I asked. Your father was smart, she replied. When Popeye headed his way, your dad got out of the way. Later, I checked the facts in Pullen, an all-around athlete in football. He started all 4 years as a powerful offensive back, 6'2", 190 pounds, and defensive lineman for Arcola. Remarkably, his team won 33 straight games through the mid to late 30s, outscoring opponents 690-43. During Popeye's four-year career, Tuscola's strong football team and Arcola's legendary rival never scored a point against Arcola. With the war imminent, and despite numerous college offers to play football at the end of his storied prep career, Popeye enlisted in the U.S. Navy. A year after his enlistment, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, destroying the heart of our naval fleet. At the time, Popeye was in the USS Houston, a heavy cruiser known as the Galloping Ghost of the Java Coast. Stationed in the Philippines 2 months after Pearl's attack, the USS Houston was part of a small fleet of ships from other nations cut off from the mainland without hope of reinforcement and facing a far superior invading Imperial Japanese naval fleet streaming its way. A 2007 book, Ship of Ghosts, the story of the USS Houston, FDR's legendary career, lost cruiser, and epic saga of her survivors by James Hahn Fisher, tells the saga of the USS Houston and the battles it fought before sinking. The author brings to life the awesome terror of nighttime battles that turned decks into strobe-lit slaughterhouses, the deadly rain of fire from Japanese bombers, and the almost superhuman effort of the crew as they miraculously escaped disaster again and again until their luck ran out in the Sunda Strait. There, hopelessly outnumbered, the Houston was finally sunk and its survivors taken prisoners. For more than 3 years, their fate would be a mystery to families back home. Of the 1,168 men on board the USS Houston, 800 died on that fateful February 1942 day. Popeye was one of the 368 that dove into a dark, churning sea and survived, but his survival was short-lived. He and others were taken as prisoners to what they were called Burma, now Myanmar, to work like slaves on a railroad bridge known as the Burma-Thailand Death Railway through the impassable, inhospitable Burmese jungle. The book said the survivors daily fought starvation, disease, physical and psychological torture. Critics say a very sanitized, gentle portrayal of the ordeal of the prisoners during the building of the rail through Burma jungle was made into the 1957 Oscar Best Film of the Year, The Bridge on the River Kwai. Popeye never made it out of Burma. On page 505 of the book, at least Robert H. Pullen, POW, of 100 Kilo Camp Burma, having died on August 31st, 1943, almost 5 years to the day after his last football game. He died of tropical ulcers from just a scratch from a leaf, a bug bite, some small wound that got infected and was left untreated. And he was to die like almost everyone else in the 100 Kilo Camp. Less than one in five sailors of the USS Houston made it home alive. In a cruel irony of war, this young man with some of the most powerful legs ever seen on the old Oka Conference was felled by a simple scratch to one of them. My father also served in the Navy, enlisting shortly after the Battle of Sunda Straits. At Atwood Farm, boy who had never saw water deeper than the local creek after a summer thunderstorm, my dad suddenly found himself sailing the same waters as Popeye, the Pacific and Indian Ocean and the China Sea, skirting the same islands like Java. They were both so far from home, these two small-town Douglas County boys who played football against each other just a few years earlier, so young and vulnerable, smack dab in harm's way. This time, my father wasn't just smart, but also lucky. He was one of the fortunate soldiers that got to return home to lead a full life. Upon arriving back at Great Lakes Naval Station in Chicago, he saw his almost 2-year-old daughter for the first time as my mother proudly held Melinda up to him. Dad settled in Tuscola, unflaggingly supporting his family in various jobs, being a good friend to many, a loving father to his family, always there for us, until dying at age 78. All soldiers are in harm's way. Their and their families' loved ones suffer and sacrifice in some way. Their efforts have always been and always will support this nation. We owe our blessings of strength and prosperity and freedom to their courage and sacrifice. Veterans Day is a time to tell and retell our stories of our veterans. I have related Popeye's story many times over the years in print and public talks, and I will continue as long as I can. We validate, commemorate, and show appreciation for their efforts, their valor and sacrifice, endured within the unimaginable cruel chaos of war, then remember them by telling and retelling their stories, lest we forget. The next article, Addressing Poverty Through Empathy and Understanding, Ramblin' Man, David Porter. How poor should poor people be? I've heard the banter. They should get a job and pay taxes like the rest of us. They should have to make sacrifices. They buy cigarettes and booze and junk food. They all have cell phones. Seems if you're poor and you take government handouts, you should never have anything that someone else might consider to be fun or a luxury. If you're rich and you take government handouts, well, that's just smart business. We don't seem to have a lot of empathy toward those of us who are the neediest among us. We seem to think everyone starts out in life with the same intelligence, capabilities, resources, and choices of what we have. If you want to get ahead in life, you need to work harder and smarter like we did. I think a lot of us were poor at one point, but we made those sacrifices and hard choices. We scratched and clawed our way out of poverty's hole. I've been poor, at least poor adjacent, not destitute, not starving. Other than COVID benefits for my business, I never took a government assistance, except once, although I didn't know it at the time. I was just a little kid. I didn't know I was eating free lunch at school. It was more than 50 years ago. My dad got laid off from his job after 16 years of service. My mom didn't work at the time and was raising 6 children between the age of 3 and 13. Even still, we were not destitute and would have survived without the assistance. My parents were savers, and my dad had real estate investments that provided income. He also worked odd jobs for a year before he found employment in a coal mine. We had a large garden and canned the food for the winter. Even when Dad was working, we lived frugally with hand-me-down and yard sale clothes. My bed was bought at an auction and was handmade from plywood. Since our household income dropped significantly, we qualified for free lunches. My mother signed us up and Dad never knew. She figured we'd paid our share of taxes. While we could survive a long time, no one knew how long we would have to endure and what we might have to give up. The assistance was a way to stretch the dollars that we had. As soon as Dad got hired at the mine, the assistance stopped. I think most people would agree that it was okay to accept the temporary help. We were good people who made good decisions, and we didn't need the help for very long. That's what the assistance is there for. By contrast, there's a family I knew about 15 years ago who relied heavily on assistance. I want to make clear up front that I have empathy for them, but I'm not sure everyone else would. The couple were not married. She was a server in a restaurant that I frequented. He was a cook in the same restaurant. They had 3 children at home. Together, they had one more on the way. They moved frequently because they would get evicted for not paying their rent. They had little furniture to move. They had no bed frames, just mattresses on the floor, no bed sheets. The houses they lived in were in poor repair and often infested with cockroaches. I don't know for certain, but I think they found ways to attain alcohol and marijuana. Just 2 more poor choices. But is it really? It's probably the cheapest way to escape your own reality. To their credit, they were both working, but their income was minimal with no health care benefits. They had no car, so they biked or walked to work or took the bus. They couldn't afford daycare, so their teenage son was often left in charge of his younger sisters. Occasionally, I would hire him to do yard work. I noticed he had an iPhone. He explained that his aunt had gotten him a new phone, and she gave him her old iPhone. He wasn't on cellular plan. When he could save up $40 mowing job, he would go to the store and buy a phone card. A phone allowed him to access free Wi-Fi, keep in touch with his friends and his odd job customers, and help them to fit in at school. I think it's pretty normal to want to look like you're not poor, like the adage, dress for the job you want, not the job you have. I don't want to paint the family as saintly community leaders or role models. They made poor choices. They weren't dumb, but they didn't have the wherewithal to make better choices. There are a lot of factors that can work for or against a person: education, intellect, health history, criminal history, family resources, professional networking, personality, physical appearance, etc. For this particular family, they just had their hands full with multiple challenges. They didn't have the skills they needed that could lead to better paying jobs, compounded with a lack of family planning and an inability to prioritize what little money they had. What they lacked the most was hope. They'd been so poor for so long that it had become their lifestyle. What would they do without assistance? Take to stealing? Split up the family? Homelessness? To say that these people were barely getting by would be an understatement. Then one day I went to the restaurant for lunch and it was permanently closed. I never knew what became of them after that. It was as if they had just vanished. I have empathy for them for several reasons. They were friendly, nice people. No amount of assistance was ever going to make them self-reliant. Despite how poorly they fared, they were doing the best they could. They wanted to take care of themselves. They wanted to work and were willing to be able to work. And they were hard workers. Even if they had ability to learn more marketable skills, they didn't have the time. Their mountains of debt seemed too high to climb. I don't think they're really all that different from me. I'm more fortunate in many ways. I've arguably made better decisions, but mostly because I had better choices. It doesn't make me better than them. I don't know what the answer is, but there is not a single answer, but it starts with understanding and empathy. So I ask again, how poor should poor people be? And we have time to read some briefs. Community Thanksgiving Services. The Arthur Ministerial Association is sponsoring a Community Thanksgiving Service on Sunday, November 23rd at Penn Station, 122 East Progress Street, Arthur, at 10 a.m. Come and join area churches for this special time of giving thanks to the Lord through worship, prayer, singing, scripture, and testimony. Prelude music and singing will begin at 9:40 a.m. with cookies and drink being served as they fellowship together before the service. Let us come together and give thanks and praise Jesus during this season of Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving dinner. Brookstone Estates, 1106 East North Line Road, Tuscola, invites the public to share in a Thanksgiving dessert from 1 to 3 p.m. November 27th. Please RSVP at 217-253-6300. Tuscola Turkey Trot. The Tuscola 5K Turkey Trot is November 27th. Registration begins at 8 a.m. at Irvin Park. Chili Fundraiser. Chili for Chaddock Supper, sponsored by the Tuscola United Methodist Men, will begin at 8 p.m. Thursday, November 20th at the Tuscola United Methodist Church. All net proceeds by donation will go to the Chaddock Children's Foundation in support of their work with troubled children and their families. All are invited. Please come, invite your family, friends, and neighbors, and enjoy food, fellowship, and chili or vegetable soup. A blood drive. Villa Grove High School's FFA is sponsoring a blood drive from 7:30 to 11 a.m. Monday, November 21st in the Little Gym, 400 North Sycamore. To make an appointment, call Impact Life at 800-747-5401 or visit thebloodcenter.org and use code 70131. Arcola Food Collection. Arcola Masonic Lodge number 366 will be distributing sacks to every home in Arcola on Saturday, November 15th for pack-a-sack collection for the Arcola Food Pantry. Residents are asked to fill the sacks with non-perishable food items and leave them on the front steps for collection on Saturday, November 22nd from 9 to 11 a.m. If a sack is not picked up by 11 a.m., call 268-4197. Arcola Senior Potluck. Arcola seniors are invited to attend a holiday potluck at the Arcola Center on November 21st. Lunch will begin at 11:30 a.m. Holiday music will be played for those attending. Seniors may bring a dish to share. Arthur Events, November 15th, 3rd Saturday Bazaar at Auto Center. November 16th, Turkey Bingo at ALAH High School Gym. November 17th, Senior Luncheon at the Community Building. November 23rd, Community Thanksgiving Service at Penn Station. November 27th, Happy Thanksgiving. November 28th, Black Friday Shopping Event at County Line Stores, Auto Center, and Downtown Arthur. November 29th, Toy Auction, Antique Auction, Tri-County Auction Facility. And November 29th, Advertising, Signage, Petroliana, Collectibles, Auction at Tri-City Auction Facility. That is all the time we have for the news this week. This is Chris Yerke saying goodbye and see you again next week.